Thanks for tuning into Radio Times. I'm Katie Meyer, in for Mary Cummings Jordan. Today's the first day that Philadelphians are once again required to wear masks indoors, so we're kicking off this Monday regional roundup with a discussion of the changes in COVID-19 case rates that precipitated this policy shift. So why Philly is taking a harder line on masking than other major cities, and also how some people are trying to stop it. Joining us to explain all that is WHYY health reporter Nina Feldman. Welcome, Nina.
Thanks, Katie.
Thanks for coming on. And by the way, we welcome your questions and comments. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, or you can call in 888-477-9499. Okay, so Nina, masks are back. What are case rates doing that city officials have decided that this step was necessary?
Cases are going up in Philadelphia, as they are in Pennsylvania and New Jersey. The entire Northeast, cases are rising. In the past couple of weeks, cases in Philly have gone up by more than 80%, which is, you know, on its face, pretty dramatic, although cases still do remain low, especially in comparison to what we've seen, you know, during the Omicron wave and the Delta wave before that. It is worth noting, as health officials have many times, that what we're seeing in terms of the official case counts is likely a dramatic undercount because so many people are confirming positive results with just a rapid test at home, which there's no official avenue for reporting to the health department. So we're probably seeing way less than there actually is, but there's an increase in cases. So that's triggering the mask response.
Well, and tell me a little bit more about that, because Philly has a pretty, I would say, strict mask requirement as opposed to other cities. We're the only major city so far that has put this requirement back in place. So what's the threshold here, and why is Philly so strict in comparison to, like, New York, D.C., places like that?
That's right. So the CDC developed a sort of risk measurement system for how to gauge, you know, how much COVID is going around and what we should do in response to that. And then, you know, they also said, feel free to develop your own system that's similar, you know, wherever you are. And that's exactly what Philadelphia did. So they developed their own kind of tiered risk system, which triggers a mask requirement in indoor spaces if daily cases exceed 100, you know, daily new COVID cases reported, and if two of the following three things are true. So daily cases have to exceed 100, cases have to increase by more than 50% over the past 10 days, and hospitalizations have to exceed 50. So if two out of those three things are true, then mask mandate indoors get automatically triggered. And so our hospitalizations are low here, but that case level and the increase rate both meet the requirement to go into the mask mode. So in some ways, it wasn't really a decision at all. It was just a sort of automatic response based on the system that the health officials had laid out several months ago.
Yeah. And then the tiers continue after that. So is there also a threshold at which, for instance, like the indoor vaccine mandates for like restaurants and gyms and things like that comes back too?
That's right. That would be the next level. So level three, if we get to 225 new cases a day on average, and if cases continue to increase and the hospitalizations bump to over 100, that would spark the vaccine mandate in indoor spaces as well, which we had before, you know, right around the Omicron wave. So we're not there yet.
Not quite. And so then, on all of this, there's been some significant pushback, especially from restaurant owners, some business owners who say, you know, this is premature. Other cities are not doing this. This is harsh. And there's a lawsuit that got filed in state court over the weekend trying to get the mandate overturned. So tell me about that. Who's bringing it and what are they arguing?
It's a group of residents and business owners who basically say that Philadelphia is eschewing the CDC's guidelines in their own, in creating their own sort of rogue risk determination system. Which, I mean, I'm not a legal expert, so I'm not going to weigh in on the merits there, but I will say that there's no, you know, federal requirement for jurisdictions to follow the CDC's guidelines. They're simply guidelines. And in fact, the CDC encourages municipalities and localities to develop their own systems. So I'll just say that That seems like a steep argument to to mount to me. And I will also note that the city just had a favorable ruling with a similar lawsuit that came out in their favor in terms of challenging some of these mandates. So it seems like the courts generally favor the city's discretion on this type of thing. But the point stands of the people challenging the mandate, which is that, you know, people are sick of this and they feel like, why are we the only ones doing this at such a lower level? You know, what's the justification?
Yeah, yeah. Well, we'll talk about that a little bit more because the politics of this, I think, are relevant and interesting. What sort of responses are you seeing from public officials about this mandate, and especially about Philly, again, being the first big city to go in this direction?
Right. Well, there are some reasons. You know, I mean, Health Commissioner Cheryl Bettegol said, basically, better safe than sorry. You know, if we don't get out ahead of the wave, it'll be too late to stop it. Once once cases are high enough that it seems like it warrants a mandate, well, then you will already have seen the sort of jumpstart of hospitalizations coming through, and, you know, then deaths tend to follow. So it's better to be too soon than too late, was her argument. The other thing she said is that, you know, why Philly might be different than other places is that, you know, we're the poorest big city in America, and there are more low-income residents here who are more likely to have some of the comorbidities or chronic illnesses that make it so that COVID can be more serious and land you in the hospital or, you know, be fatal in the worst-case scenario. So I think her argument there was, every city has its different calculus based on its populace, and she's in charge of making these decisions for Philadelphia, not for New York or for the suburbs.
Yeah, yeah. And I'll just note, too, I mean, because we are coming into midterm elections and, you know, everybody thinks about these things in terms of politics. Josh Shapiro, who's running for governor, did say at a press conference the other day that he thought that, well, first of all, he's like, this wasn't my decision, I'm just the attorney general, but that he thought maybe it was premature or overkill. So you definitely, and he's, again, a Democrat who generally has been aligned with other Democrats on, you know, more cautious mask options. So there's some kind of a dynamic there where people think that, oh, you know, people don't love this.
Right.
Well, and then to your sort of point about, like, you know, better safe than sorry, or Bettegol's point, what is the evidence, Nina, at this point, that, like, the mask mandates do have an overall effect on case rates? Like, do we have, like, strong correlations? What's the science there?
It's really hard to do, you know, the sort of gold standard randomized control trial on something like this, because there are so many variables, and because obviously county borders are porous. You have people commuting back and forth between work and home, in Philadelphia and the neighboring counties, which, you know, will not reimpose mask mandates and didn't, you know, prior when we had it before here in Philadelphia. Many of the surrounding counties did not. But what we can say about that period of time, when Philly had a mask mandate and the neighboring collar counties didn't, was that you did see slightly lower case rates here. Now, again, can you attribute that fully to the mask mandate? It's hard to say. There are tons of variables. There are vaccination rates, which play a role. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of different things that you can kind of potentially draw those conclusions about, but, you know, I don't think that the mask mandate is is to be ignored in that calculation.
Yeah. Well, and I also want to note, like, I think a little bit funny, like, part of the mask mandate. The city announced that it was going to happen last week, but they gave, like, a reintroduction period.
Right.
What was, why did they do that? What was their goal there? They kind of thought people were going to forget how to wear masks?
I think it was more about for the businesses to kind of give everybody time to adjust and gear up. But, you know, you did have some criticism coming from the other end of things, from the other end of the spectrum, about that week-long ramp-up period where, you know, during that week was Easter and Passover, where you have lots of opportunities for people to gather indoors together. So the idea, you know, if the justification for the mask mandate is we want to stop spreading infection before it gets too serious or bad, you do sort of question, well, why do you leave a week when there's huge gathering opportunities for infection to spread? So, you know, I don't think any of these policies are, are totally sound or foolproof or bulletproof. There's some holes, and I think I will say, whatever you think of it, I think the health department is in a tricky position where you can't make everybody happy.
Right. Well, and then just back to like the underlying issue here. We've now got a new variant, BA2. And for those of us who are, you know, trying to keep up on all the various variants, what do we know about this one? How severe is it?
Well, it's a sub-variant of Omicron, okay, which means that most likely the, our immune response is roughly the same to this variant as it is to Omicron. And scientists think, and again, this research is still emerging, but they think that, you know, people who had the original Omicron infection are probably going to be able to yield a pretty strong immune defense to BA2, which might be what is preventing this surge from becoming super dramatic as other ones have been, because there's a relative level of immunity among the general population. That said, it is more contagious. If people, what we're starting to see now is that a lot of people who've been really careful and have been doing their best to avoid getting COVID up until this point for the past 2 years might be getting infected now because the virus is just finding the hosts that are left, the people who, you know, haven't mounted that immunity. So that's sort of where we're at with BA2, and research is definitely still emerging on it since it is so new.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and you had mentioned before with case rates rising, again, like the context is important. We're still far below the high points of the Omicron wave and also, you know, Delta before that. But you mentioned hospitalizations. They've still been pretty low. Is that usually a lagging indicator? Are we expecting to, you know, see that maybe rise a little bit?
Yeah, so I think the hope is to prevent that from rising, right, by putting these measures into place. And yes, usually we see hospitalizations rise a couple of weeks after case rates go up, which is another reason I should say that the Philadelphia system, the risk system, tries to rely less on hospitalizations as sort of an indicator that things are going to get bad than the CDC system. The CDC system uses hospital capacity and the number of people with COVID in the hospital much more heavily as a way to sort of indicate how much caution we should be taking than Philly's system does. And I talked to a lot of public health experts who say they don't actually think that makes sense if what you're trying to do is prevent a surge in infections, because if the hospitalizations are heavy, then we're already too late. You know, you got a lot of people in the hospital. So in that sense, Philly's system is like a little bit more sensitive to heading off a surge at the pass. Whereas the CDC's is much more focused on kind of looking at what's happening right now.
Gotcha. Well, Nina Feldman, WHYY's health reporter, thank you so much for updating us on all of this. Up next, we're talking to about another public health issue, a powerful tranquilizer that's become an increasingly common additive to street drugs in Philly. Stay tuned. We'll be back after the break.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
We're back again with Radio Times. I'm Katie Meyer, in for Mary Cummings Jordan. Public health experts are raising the alarm about an animal tranquilizer that's getting more common in the drugs sold in Philadelphia and many other cities. A study recently found it was present in more than a quarter of 2020 overdose deaths in Philly. The drug is xylazine. It's commonly known as tranq or tranq dope. And joining us now to talk about how it's affecting people and how to keep people safer are Sarah Laurel and Jen Scheinfeld. Sarah founded Savage Sisters, a local nonprofit that provides harm reduction and sober homes for people in recovery. And Jen is a field epidemiologist in the Division of Substance Use and Harm Reduction for the city. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming in. And by the way, we welcome your questions and comments. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times or call in 888-477-9499. All right. So, Jen, I'll start with you. I think A lot of people know this by now, but it bears repeating. Drugs change over time. And just briefly, can you walk us through some of these major changes we've seen in the drugs that people commonly are using in Philly? So we went from, for instance, heroin, and then fentanyl became much more common. And now there's this additional additive that I think we're seeing more, right?
So Philadelphia was known for...
You're good.
Okay. So Philadelphia was always known for having the purest heroin in the United States. And then around 2006 is when we first started to see xylazine, also known as trank, in the supply is when we first started to see it come across in our toxicology. And also around 2011, and Sarah, correct me at any point or jump in.
Yeah.
We started to get fentanyl in the Philadelphia drug supply and started to have pure fentanyl corners in Philadelphia as well, and started to have that transition. And I can't name exactly when we went to a full transition from no longer having just heroin corners to having mostly fentanyl corners in Philadelphia. But once those fentanyl mostly took over the city, also is when we saw much more tranquilizer on the city as well.
Well, and tell me too, like, so trank, my understanding, obviously it's tranquilizer, and often what people like about it is it extends the high that you get from fentanyl. Is that right? So what does it do? What's the, like, why is this added to these drugs?
So initially xylazine was added into the cut when fentanyl first started to come out, and I learned about xylazine in 2011 when fentanyl was coming around, and it was added to fentanyl because it had a much shorter half-life than heroin. And xylazine was added because it gave the fentanyl longer legs and gave people more of that traditional heroin nod.
Okay.
And longer lasting. So it's not something that people are looking for or necessarily like. It causes blackouts. It does not get people well. It doesn't provide like the warm hug of like a traditional opioid or things like that.
It doesn't provide the relief of, you know, for somebody who's addicted.
Correct.
Right. And so in your work, so actually quickly, Sarah, I mean, tell me a little bit about Savage Sisters. What are the services that you do and what kind of work are you doing with drug users?
So Savage Sisters, we have six sober living facilities for men and women, and those are located in South Philadelphia. We do harm reduction education and Narcan training, and we also do street-based outreach. Our street-based outreach includes distributing harm reduction supplies, Narcan, clothing, food, shoes, and we have a few nurses that volunteer with us to do wound care, which we increased those services over the past 2 years as the xylazine basically took over the dope supply in Philadelphia. And there's several reasons that individuals don't go to hospitals. I've been asked this before. Number one, unfortunately, a lot of times they're not treated with compassion and tolerance. Number two, because of the very brief amount of time that an individual is in a state of being comfortable enough to sit still, they don't want to go to a hospital for 4 to 8 hours to be treated. So we found that it was the best way that we could serve individuals that were housing insecure and addicted to trank dope that we were serving or any substances was to meet them exactly where they were at with the wound care wrapping and then giving them kits that they could take with them to administer themselves.
Well, and tell me a little bit about how the introduction of this tranquilizer has affected the work that you're doing, because, for instance, it's not really responsive to Narcan, right?
I think the biggest things are the wounds, and there's not a lot of access, especially in Kensington, for individuals to use public restrooms and showers and laundry services. So they have these open wounds in, on their body, and then they don't have a way to properly clean it or maintain a certain level of hygiene because there's no access to it for them. So infection can spread rapidly. And it's not just injection sites. It's popping up all over their body in different areas. So that's been one of the challenges. And then the reversing of the overdose when, you know, when I was homeless in Kensington 5 years ago, when you would hit somebody with Narcan, it was, they were very responsive to Narcan within, I would say, 2 minutes. Mm. And now we're not, you're not reversing just an opioid overdose. So the way that we're doing the training has changed, and we're really strongly encouraging people to not over Narcan individuals. This kind of very panicked thing sets in, so we're trying to get people to calm down, administer Narcan 3 minutes apart, and in between that time, focus on rescue breathing. No chest compressions, just rescue breathing, because the most important thing is they're being put to sleep by this tranquilizer, and you want oxygen to continue to get to their brain while the Narcan is working, if that makes sense. So
yeah, it does.
It's been challenging, and I think that there are so many individuals that do come down to Kensington and they want to be helpful, and they're serving our friends down there. But I think it's key that we really learn how to do this reversal, and that we stay vigilant when we are doing the rescue breathing, because if you know, if you're like me 5 years ago and you see Narcan's not working, you think this person's gone, but they're not. So it's important to really continue that rescue breathing.
Right. And just to be clear, so this kind of this effect of the tranquilizer that you're talking about, it just it knocks you out. People will just go unconscious for what period of time usually? Does it depend?
It depends on how much they're injecting or consuming, I should say.
Sure.
Of course, it depends on the variation that and what they've mixed it with as well. It could be 15 minutes. They could be responsive. They could be somewhat responsive. So the first thing that we always do is try and see if they respond to verbal or physical stimuli. Mm. And we'll put them into the rescue position, and just to kind of make sure the blood's flowing and their airways aren't blocked, if they're slightly responsive. If they're absolutely, you know, in need of an overdose reversal, you just kind of have to stay with them and get the ambulance on their way so that they can help with it. But it doesn't, there's no, somebody could be knocked out for 20 minutes. Somebody could be knocked out for 8 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Just depends on.
Yeah. Well, and the wounds that you mentioned as well, I think that's important just to be clear. So this is caused by the tranquilizer. Do we know what exactly causes the wounds, and how severe are they?
There's no consensus from the medical community about what and why and how these wounds are being caused.
Right.
Xylazine acts on the alpha-2 agonists in the brain. It's also a vasoconstrictor, so it slows the blood flow in the body. So it also slows healing time. But as Sarah was saying, these wounds pop up all over the body. They don't just occur at the site of injection. And also, they're not just occurring in people who are injecting. They're occurring in, it doesn't matter, modality of use. People who snort are also getting these wounds. People who smoke are also getting these wounds.
Yeah, and they can be really severe, right?
They're extremely severe, and they progress very quickly. They're much more likely to become infected, and there's a lot more sepsis, endocarditis. We're seeing a lot more amputations as well that are occurring from this.
And so one of the other things I think bears mentioning, test strips, obviously that's been a really important part of, you know, keeping people safe when they're using fentanyl. Are there test strips for this?
There are no xylazine test strips, which is a push. We fetishize fentanyl test strips, but the drug supply is so volatile and changes constantly.
Yeah. So it's really, I mean, you can know if there's some fentanyl in something, but there could be any number of other things that you're just not going to know about.
Correct.
Yeah. And Sarah, you had mentioned the compassion aspect of this. When people are going to get treatment, you know, making them want to stay in treatment and making it comfortable enough for them to be there. Are there specific, first of all, are there, you know, describe the conditions for somebody who does want to get treatment. What usually are they up against, or what situation are they walking into?
It depends on what kind of treatment you mean. So there's wound care treatment for the infections, where they're, unfortunately, the hospitals in Kensington that are in that surrounding area, I would say they've been overwhelmed with this epidemic, and that they're trying to do the best that they can. But the willingness to kind of sit still and be in that uncomfortable space, because it's it's a similar detox to heroin, but it's exaggerated, if that makes sense, and it's not being met. Now, if you're trying to get into actual rehab, there's new changes to accessing rehab because of these open wounds on people's skins. You can't just, 5 years ago, you could call, do an intake over the phone, and then enter into a treatment facility. Now you have to be medically cleared because of these infections and open wounds, which is just another barrier for an individual seeking treatment. And then once they actually get over that hurdle and get into a treatment facility, the treatment facilities are only treating the opioid withdrawal. Then the individual has whatever they're using, whether it's methadone, Suboxone, Subutex, then they aren't treating the trank withdrawal. So individuals are very uncomfortable. And the recidivism rates are going up because that detox isn't being met medically. And so they are going to leave so that they can ease that pain. So it's affecting things all over as far as, the physical health with the wounds and the infections. And then once they get to that space where they can actually treat substance use disorder, we really need to make it a priority to focus on creating a level of comfort for those individuals that are experiencing that detox so that they can sit still long enough to get through the acute withdrawal time.
Are there any specific changes that you, Sarah, or you, Jen, would say that, like, make sense, or just, like, obvious changes that, city or state-run facilities could make, or private facilities, nonprofits, just broad changes that need to happen?
These facilities should have wound care and nurses on staff at each site so they can do the medical clearance and availability there.
And it just does not happen now?
It's not available there, and there's a number of reasons that that is not occurring. Comfort care needs to be changed as well. And it's dependent also upon someone needs to test positive for a certain drug to be treated for those withdrawal symptoms, and people are not testing for trank, and there is no standardized level of care for trank withdrawal, despite the fact that the withdrawal symptoms from that are very similar to withdrawal from benzodiazepines, which puts people at risk for seizures and can be deadly.
And why do you think these kind of responses have lagged? Is it just that people are catching up to a new reality? What is it?
Why do you think? I don't know how to say this. I don't think that there's enough compassion and care for the individuals that are in pain. I think there's a lot of stigma around it. And I also think that there have been multiple grassroots organizations, and including, the harm reduction unit at the Department of Health, that have been jumping up and down about this issue. But at the end of the day, there is this kind of cold attitude of, well, just, sit through it. We haven't tested for it, and it's not written in the books yet. So unfortunately, I think it has to do with stigma and a lack of compassion and a lack of individuals with lived experience having a voice at the table.
Well, one of the things that's come up a lot in Philly and in other cities is safe injection sites. Now, this is kind of part, I think, of a host of that type of proposal where you are trying to make the act of taking drugs, because people are addicted to drugs, safer. What has been, obviously there was enormous opposition to that in the neighborhoods where these sites were proposed. Have you seen any movement on this as when it comes to trank? What's the dynamic that you're observing? I guess I'll start with you, Jen. Or Sarah, you want to start, Sarah? Go ahead.
I haven't seen any movement. Yeah. I've seen a lot of community conflict and misunderstanding. And I think that it will take a level of open conversations between everybody involved, the residential community, the community that's actively using, and those advocating harm reductionists and people in substance use disorder treatment world. I think we really need to bring it to a table discussion and move forward with it. However, I think right now we're overwhelmed with crisis management.
And I do, I mean, again, to your point, crisis management, I think, is like the top of line item here. But there's another, I would say, solutions oriented thing that comes up when you have these conversations. And it's a safe drug supply. Now, in Canada, in parts of Europe, that's been something that's been instituted where basically you get, you know, clean heroin. People who are addicted to it can access it and take it in a controlled way. Do you have any thoughts on that or like what it would do for this problem?
I mean, you're talking my language right now. The problem is we live in a prohibitionist society, and one of the things that scares me the most about the conversations around Trank that we've been having and that the media has picked up on so recently is it reminds me a lot about the conversations that were had around fentanyl however many years ago, and we keep scheduling fentanyl and scheduling all the new fentanyl analogs, and the new fentanyl analogs that come out now in Philadelphia, we had parafluorofentanyl that just came out in 2020, which actually has a much higher toxicity rate in the human body. And now that's scheduled. So we have to see what the new fentanyl analog that comes out is. And now we're talking about Trank, and we know how dangerous Trank is in the human body. So now that everyone's getting their hands and heads on that, if we end up scheduling that, what's next? And we can't keep doing, we're not learning from our history. Mm-hmm. So
your point being that it's always going to evolve. That's just what's happened over time.
That's what's happened. So we need to learn from our history. And the step is safe supply. We need to keep people safe.
Mm-hmm. And Sarah, anything you would add to that?
No.
No.
I agree with it. I think that it's a conversation that needs to happen. But I think that... And since I've been doing this work, unfortunately, there's so much opposition to it, even though we have safe consumption sites. They're called bars. But let's not talk about that.
Well, and again, I think just on the sort of solutions side, it sounds like the rubric for this is there needs to be just the basic, you know, wound care and triage that needs to happen. And then you would like to, it sounds like, have these much broader discussions, but... I don't know. How far do you think we are from that reality, Sarah? Or Jen, either one of you.
I think we're pretty far, and I think it's safe to – so the thing is, as a person who has lived experience, mm-hmm. and I've been actively using substances, I was never seeking out the drugs that were being put into the supply. I was seeking out heroin in its purest form.
All right. Well, hey, thanks so much, both of you, for coming on, and we will be back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Back again with Radio Times. I'm Katie Meyer, in for Mary Cummings Jordan. And now we move to a totally different topic for our final segment, the Atlantic sturgeon. As a species, dates back to the time of the dinosaurs. But more recently, they're under a lot of threats from humans. They've been overfished. They get hit by boats. There can be a lack of oxygen in the rivers where they live, like our very own Delaware River. To tell us more about the fight to save these fish, we welcome Delaware River keeper Maya Van Rossum. Maya, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me, Katie.
Oh, thanks for coming on. So, and by the way, we welcome questions and comments. As always, you can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, tweet us, WHYY Radio Times, or you can call in 888-477-9499. So, Maya, I would like to start with the billboard that you just put up recently. It's up over I-95 right now. And it says, "Extinction sucks. The Delaware River Atlantic sturgeon need your help." Why is this a pressing issue right now? Why are you raising the alarm?
Well, the Delaware River is home to actually a genetically unique population of Atlantic sturgeon that exists nowhere else on Earth but in our beautiful Delaware River. And because of the actions and activities of people, in recent decades, we actually have less than 300 spawning adults left of our Delaware River population. So they are in a very precarious situation, and there are actions that people can and that government should be taking to help save the sturgeon of the Delaware from extinction, but unfortunately it's not happening. So we need people to speak up in support of this, of the Atlantic sturgeon of the Delaware.
And tell me a little bit about these fish. So what I know about them, like off the top of my head, and I think maybe it's what most people know about sturgeon, is that they're big, they're kind of like prehistoric, and that's kind of it. Tell me, what else should I know about the Atlantic sturgeon?
Well, the Atlantic sturgeon can live to be as old as 60 years old, which is amazing. But they don't start to reproduce until, depending on whether they're male or female, until they're 7 to 20 years old. And so, you know, they have a unique life cycle, which means they need protection, particularly in those early years, so they actually can reproduce. They tend to feed off of the bottom of the Delaware River. They live in the Delaware estuary, so it's from the Trenton reach of the river all the way down through the bay. And as you said, they've been around since the time of the dinosaurs, so they have survived many cataclysmic events here on Earth. But the question now remains, will they survive humans? And we're hoping they will, and we're hoping humans will step up for them.
Humans, always the most cataclysmic event. And these things, they can get really huge, right, the sturgeon?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
They can, you know, 5 to 6 feet long when they reach adult age. So, and they can continue, they continue to grow even after they become fully mature adults. In fact, I think the largest Atlantic sturgeon that's been found on the East Coast was 14 feet long.
Oh my God.
So it's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Well, and the reason I want to paint a picture of this fish because they have faced, I think, various challenges over the years. How has the population fluctuated? You know, how many at their peak were there and what has happened to them since?
Well, the Delaware River population of Atlantic sturgeon actually was the largest population in North America at one time. We had about 180,000 spawning adults in our beautiful Delaware River. In fact, there were so many sturgeon that according to historic accounts, you could walk across the backs of the sturgeon from side of the Delaware to the other. Of course, we hear that about shad and about trees as well.
Sure.
But nonetheless, it really talks about how many sturgeon we had in our beautiful Delaware River. And they are, as you said, they're very ancient looking and they're very, very beautiful. But because of habitat loss, because of vessel strikes, because of dredging in the river, and because of pollution, which has resulted in a lack of oxygen, we are, as I said, now down to 300 spawning adults left. In fact, in about 1990, we actually thought that we had lost our Delaware River population of Atlantic sturgeon. And then amazingly, this one baby was found, and you can actually find a picture of that baby on our special website, dinointhedelaware.org. You can find the one baby that helped alert scientists to the fact that we hadn't actually lost our Atlantic sturgeon population. They were still there, but they needed our protection.
Yeah. Well, and I want to ask specifically about one of the challenges that you mentioned, the lack of oxygen in the river, because there are criteria that I think federal criteria that's put forth to say, you know, a river needs to have this much oxygen to keep fish safe. But is the Delaware River, in your opinion, is it falling short? Are we not doing enough for the animals that live in there?
The Delaware River is absolutely falling short when it comes to oxygen protection. Actually, the dissolved oxygen standard that's set for the Delaware River is set by an agency called the Delaware River Basin Commission, which is a collective of the four watershed states as well as the federal government. The oxygen standard that has been set for the reach of the river where the sturgeon live and need to procreate and thrive is 50 years old, and it's set at 3.5 milligrams per liter. Just remember, 3.5. Why that number matters is because sturgeon need almost double that amount. Mm. They need about 6.3 milligrams per liter to survive, to procreate, and to thrive. And so we at the Delaware Riverkeeper Network, along with our partner organizations, Environment New Jersey, Clean Air Council, and Penn Future, have been fighting to get those oxygen standards raised so that they are protective of the sturgeon. But unfortunately, the Delaware River Basin Commission, the four watershed states, and the federal government are taking their sweet time. And we don't have time when it comes to the Atlantic sturgeon.
Well, who are the players in this? Are there other, you know, entities that are pushing back against your, you know, conclusion that we need way more oxygen in the river? Are they, you know, trying to balance interests here?
Unfortunately, those who discharge pollution into the Delaware River are pushing back. Mm-hmm. And they're making all sorts of arguments that it's not needed, in fact, and that more scientific study is necessary in order to identify what actually is needed when it comes to dissolved oxygen, whether we're talking about the sturgeon or other fish that live in the river. Mm. But we are here to say that no more study is needed. The Delaware River Basin Commission, the National Marine Fisheries Service, scientists from all over the region have come together and put forth peer-reviewed scientific papers in recent years that are very, well, not even recent years, well over a decade, that are very, very clear. Mm-hmm. The Atlantic sturgeon needs 6.3 milligrams per liter. Other fish species also need higher levels. 3.5 milligrams per liter is like bottom of the barrel. And as I said, is a 50-year-old standard that does not meet scientific rigor at this point. It's time to upgrade and it's time to change. And it's time for the agencies to listen to the scientists, to listen to their own scientists and help protect the Atlantic sturgeon and the other aquatic life that live in our beautiful Delaware River. And we always have to remember, when we clean up water pollution to protect the fish, we're actually also cleaning up water pollution that affects people. So we all benefit by protecting the sturgeon.
And if I'm a sturgeon living in the Delaware River, let's say, and I have, as you said, like 3.5 milligrams per liter of oxygen, and I need much more, what does that do to me, a fish?
Well, I mean, I think we can just think about ourselves as people,
sure,
right? If we have about half of the oxygen we need, we may be able to hang on to life. Some of us will survive, but many won't. And whether or not we will be able to fully and appropriately form is a question. When it comes to the Atlantic sturgeon, it's very significantly a concern about whether or not they will actually be able to propagate, procreate, right? Have babies. And when you have less than 300 spawning adults left, when you have a species that doesn't start to reproduce until they've been in the river for nearly a decade, being able to have that maximum level of oxygen so that you have that body strength necessary to thrive yourself, but also to procreate and create healthy babies is fundamentally important.
Mm. I also want to ask you about the river bottom. So about a decade ago, the Army Corps of Engineers started a dredging project to deepen part of the river to allow for bigger boats. What has that project meant for the sturgeon?
So I want to be very, very
sure.
clear. You know, the Delaware Riverkeeper Network was opposed to the Delaware River Main Navigation Deepening Project since its inception. And both the industry and the Army Corps of Engineers all agreed, frankly, that deepening of the Delaware River was not essential in order to support the maritime industry along the Delaware River. We had a very robust, thriving port industry along our Delaware River then, and it could have and would have been sustained by having just the 40-foot depth main navigation channel that we had in the past. But the Army Corps of Engineers, I think largely for political reasons, wanted to deepen an additional 5 feet. So after a 20-year battle, they won, and they got to deepen the Delaware River. The ramifications have been significant. First off, they further destroyed aquatic habitat that's essential for Atlantic sturgeon, both in the main navigation channel, but also all the channels that hook up to it. Think of it as the driveways that are coming from the port industry. Mm. Every time we dredge, every time we tap into that main navigation channel, deepening further side channels, we're impacting critical habitat. We also then are bringing in larger vessels. one of the most significant threats to the Atlantic sturgeon of the Delaware River are that they are hit and sliced by the larger vessels that are coming up on the river. There's very little clearance between the bottom of the vessel and the bottom of the river where the sturgeon are hanging out, and they can get hit and, again, literally sliced up by these vessels. Mm. We have on the order of 7 to 10 sturgeon a year that are known, right, are known because we actually find the bodies, to die from vessel strikes. 10 sturgeon a year, that's about 3% of the population. That's a lot when you're trying to survive extinction. And then the other thing is that as we deepen the bottom of the river, what we do is we move the river's salt line further up. That's important because the Atlantic sturgeon actually procreate in the freshwater part of the estuary. So the further up the estuary where you don't have the salty waters, you have the freshwaters, that is the limited section of the river where the sturgeon procreate, where that water quality, that freshwater is essential for them to procreate. So as we deepen the Delaware River, we actually increase the pressure of the salt water coming up from the ocean. We shorten the length of river available for the sturgeon to procreate. Less spawning habitat means less babies. Less babies means less sturgeon. And we are bringing this species ever closer to the brink of extinction. So, you know, there are a lot of ways that the deepening and the dredging damage the river, in addition that sometimes the sturgeon themselves get directly hit by the dredging equipment. And again, we don't actually know how many because it's a matter of whether or not you see them. Often the fish that are killed in the river don't actually make it to the surface or to the shoreline, so we don't actually get to count their bodies, and we have to guesstimate.
Gotcha. And I just want to give you a chance because this, I think, might seem obvious, but make the case for this fish, if you could. For you, why is it so important that the Atlantic sturgeon, and specifically this genetic variant of the Atlantic sturgeon, why is this an important fish to preserve?
So the Atlantic sturgeon is part of our Delaware River community. It is a unique species that exists very literally nowhere else on Earth but in our beautiful Delaware River. That's important for the population itself. And then just overall, you want to have that genetic variability, right, within a species as a whole. But I think more importantly, at this point, we have brought the sturgeon so close to the brink of extinction that we can't harvest them anymore for their caviar or for any other reason, right? They don't have a direct economic use to people, and maybe for some that matters. To me, it doesn't. Mm. What really matters is that the Atlantic sturgeon is part of our Delaware River community, and it has a right to live, survive, and thrive here on Earth just as the rest of us do. Mm-hmm. We, the people, have already inflicted so much damage that we might wipe this genetically unique population off of the face of the earth so that my children, my grandchildren, if you're a listener, your children, your grandchildren, future generations may never be able to enjoy the beautiful Atlantic sturgeon of the Delaware River, and it will be our fault. That is fundamentally, morally, and legally wrong. Mm. So I think that this is really, frankly, ecologically, they're critically important to our Delaware River. Morally, we the people have a responsibility to make this right, and we need to protect this species so that we do not, in fact, become responsible for their extinction, but instead we become responsible for their return to ecological health as part of our river community.
It sounds like there is sort of a philosophical underpinning here that, you know, a lot of people might look at this and be like, well, we don't do anything with this fish, you know, so who cares? But for you, it sounds like it's more than that. It's, you know, it's a kind of a right and wrong thing almost.
It absolutely is. It's a moral responsibility. Now, if for those who do care about dollars and cents, there was a time in history when we had those 180,000 Atlantic sturgeon in the Delaware River, when actually they were a vibrant part of our economic community along the Delaware River. Actually, 70 to 75% of the caviar in this part of the world was harvested from Delaware River sturgeon, and including Atlantic sturgeon. There's another population, short-nosed sturgeon. And so actually, economically, they were a very important part of the vitality of our region. So if people care about dollars and cents, then you also want the return of the sturgeon, because they will you know, contribute economically to our communities, to our economy. To me, I think it is a sense of morality and ecological vibrance. Sturgeon belong in our Delaware River, and we want them there.
Maya, thanks so much. That's Delaware Riverkeeper Maya Van Rossum, and thanks for all of our guests this hour. We'll be back after the break.